Mrs. Hallowes, Reel One. Can you tell me, first of all, Mrs. Hallowes, how you came to join SOE?
Well, I think to a mistake, really. I'm saying a mistake because I saw in the newspaper and heard on the radio that if people had some photographs of a certain part of the coast of France, would they send them to an address in London? Of course, I sent them to the wrong address. I think I sent them to the Navy instead of the Army. But in any case, they reached where they should have been going to in the first place. And as far as I was concerned, I thought, well, this is the end of it, because, of course, I shall never get my photographs back. And they were very innocent photographs, most, I should say, of no use at all to anybody, because they were photographs of my brother and myself and taken on the beaches of France, Boulogne, Calais, all that. And But I was very surprised, because a few weeks after, I had a letter thanking me and asking me if it would ever be possible for me to come to London and have an interview at an address given. And I thought, well, probably it's to give me back my photographs. So I organized to come to London. And I was very surprised by all the questions that were asked of me. And I thought, well, the only thing I want to do, and which I said I wanted to, if I can be of any use to do some translations or adopt two or three French soldiers or send or read to a few, I would like to be able to do something. Because after all, I am French-born, and I was brought up in France. My family has always lived on the battlefield of all the wars. My father was killed 30 days before the armistice in the first one. My brother is in this one. My mother is in France, suffering with the Germans, I suppose, in her home. And so I would like to be able to do some little thing, but I have got children. Therefore, it's very limited what I can do. Well, they were very kind. They say, yes, well, we can think of something and all that. So I went back to Somerset. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. I still haven't got my photograph, so that's the end of that. And I sent my French coffee pot, you know, to be melted. I thought that was good. And tried to forget about it all for a moment. And I had some very bad news to the Red Cross of my French family.
What kind of news?
Well, my mother had to run away from her home. It was the second time in her life that she had lost everything, because it had been run over by the Germans and things that had happened to the rest of the family. My brother was no longer taking part in the war because he had been wounded and he was in the Val de Grâce, a military hospital in Paris. And some of our friends were already in captivity. And, you know, I felt terrible because I thought, well, being married to an Englishman, I am in England. I am in what I consider the safety of beautiful Somerset, with my children under those lovely trees. Am I going to be satisfied to accept this like that, that other people are going to suffer, get killed, died because of this war and trying to get freedom for my own children, let's face it. And so am I supposed to accept all this, this sacrifice that other people are making without lifting your finger in a way? And I used to say, well, I've got children and they come first, and, you know, it's easy enough to go on thinking that way. But I was tormented. And then I had a letter asking me to come back to London for another interview. So I came back, and I was told, well, you would not know the way we do these things, but we have made inquiries about you in this country and in France. And we are very satisfied with what we found. And I lost my temper. I said, well, what do you mean? Why did you have to make inquiries about me? What do you think I am? And I was told, oh, calm down. We are going to explain to you why. So I was told, well, we train people here. You will not know that, but we do. And we send them to their the country of their origin, or if they speak a foreign language very well. We send them to that country where they can use it, and they are extremely useful to the war effort. Of course, I could see that. I agreed with all that. I said, yes, well, of course, yes, I can see that. Until I was told, well, we think women could be very useful too. Then I said, yes, certainly, I think women are very useful anyway. And that did it. I was told, oh, so glad you think that way, because we are going to ask you to be one of them. I said, but no, you know. No, it's not possible. It's absolutely not possible. My children come first. I mean, I want to do everything I can for this country, which is my adopted country and the country that has adopted me. My children are English, and I have a French family, and all my roots are in France. I have two reasons who wanted to help, but I can't do that.
Were you horrified?
Absolutely. And I said, furthermore, you've got the wrong person, because certainly you must be of a certain type to do this kind of job. I am not it. I haven't got the brain for it. I haven't got the even the physical things that are necessary for the job. So no. So they say, well, we did know, of course, about your children. We don't want you to give an answer now. Go away, think. So I went back, having said no, no. And I started thinking. And I thought for months and months, thinking, oh, what do I do? I mean, you know, if everybody thinks my way, what is the future going to be for all those children everywhere? If I were in France with children, I could be like some other people who've already been captured, even with their children in concentration camp. No, because I'm here, I have a good excuse for not doing anything more than staying put with my children. I was really very tormented. So after a time, I thought, well, there is only one solution. I'll go back and say, if you like, I will do the training, and then you'll see that I'm not the right person. And at least I can come back feeling that I've tried, and, you know, I'm satisfied to have tried that. I'll think of something else to do, like knitting you, something like that. So I came back to London, and I said, well, all right, if you're still in the same mind, I'm prepared to try the training, and you will see that I'm not right for it at all.
How much pressure did they put on you to change your mind?
No, they left it to me, really. I think that's where they were clever. They knew too much about me. I think they knew that I was going to be in two minds, if you like. That you see, my background is such an extraordinary one in a way, because not having known my father, who was killed 30 days before the armistice in the First War, but I was brought up with the image of my father, who had been a very brave man. And every Sunday morning after church, I would be taken with my brother onto his grave. And my grandfather used to say, well, in 20 or 25 years' time, there is going to be another war. It will be your duty, both of you, to do as well as your father did. Well, of course, you know, I listened to that for years. And then being a girl, after a time, when I got to 14, 15, 16, the war was away, and the duties of war and everything else. I got married, engaged very young, and I got married very young, and I got children very young. And of course, you know, I wasn't war-minded, but it was there, the seed was there. That, you know, like my brother, we had to do what we could.
What did you feel at that time towards the Germans?
Well, it was very difficult, you see, because my grandparents and my mother had to live with them in the First War. They knew them well. I was too small to understand it. But I knew what they said to me for all the years after. So for me, they were, I'm not going to say evil people, because my grandparents and my mother did not have to speak of them as evil people, because in those days they were soldiers. They were not especially more evil than anybody else in the First War. But after all, they were the enemy. So there you are. They had been the enemy. I grew up with knowing that the Germans were our enemies. And once more they were. Only this time it was a different picture.
So at that time you didn't feel bitterness towards the Germans?
No, never. But then I never have, you know.
Did you discuss the proposal with your husband?
Well, he was, of course, consulted and left it to the War Office people and to me to decide. He agreed that I should do the training, and at the end of it he was told that I was acceptable, and he said, all right, if he wants to.
So he didn't try to stop you going?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Who conducted the interview with you?
Major Selwyn Jepson.
How did he conduct the interview? Can you remember?
Oh, yes, very kindly. He's a very kind person. And I think really perhaps that was the clever part of it, that you felt you could say anything to him. He's obviously a very intelligent man. He's a writer by trade. He's kind and generous, and certainly understood me extremely well.
Did you come across Colonel Buckmaster?
Yes,
during
of course.
The training?
Oh, yes, very much so. Even before I started the training. Well, it was the same story again. You know, I found there that there was a lot of understanding. In fact, I remember Maurice Buckmaster. One of the first things he said, "My good God, you look like a child yourself." When I was talking about my children, because in those days I used to look younger than my years, and I suppose I looked rather childish, and I suppose I was too. And yes, so of course I knew him well by the time I went away.
Did you like Colonel Buckmaster?
We got on very well.
Whilst you were doing the preparation for going,
yes.
Did you have opportunities for changing your mind?
Yes. Yes. You see, we were never put under pressure that way. We learned a lot, of course, during the training. I mean, it was discoveries all the time, things that were being done to people who had been captured. We were woken up in the middle of the night ourselves during the training, for example, and taken into a room with 8 or 10 men wearing German uniforms to see a reaction of shock, if you like. The training was very good. And at the end of it, you knew enough to be able to make up your mind if you wanted to go in the field or not. And you could still say, well, no, I've changed my mind, I'm not going.
During the training, yes, did it occur to you to change your mind?
No, the training made me more and more decided to do this if I could.
Was that because you were becoming more confident?
No, it was because I knew more of what was happening to other people.
Such as?
Well, you know, some people did manage to get back to England, having been caught in the field, abroad, in France or anywhere else. And they used to tell their dreadful tales. They used to tell stories of what had happened to their friends and all that. And so you had a pretty good idea of what could happen to yourself. The only confidence I had was I was confident in myself, not to do a marvelous job, that I never was, not to do perhaps marvelous physical things, but I knew that I could endure quite a lot.
You could?
Endure quite a lot. And I thought, all right, what you don't know it is once you are put against the wall or put to the test, how much you are going really and truly going to endure. But in some ways, I knew that I would have to. Because, for example, I had a suit made of charcoal gray flannel. And I think it was Vera Atkins, the office, who said, oh, why that suit? And I said, well, you see, when I go to prison, it will be very useful because it won't show the dirt like black or a pale color. And believe it or not, I wore this suit all through my captivity, turning the skirt every day an inch about so that it could be worn all over. And I came back in that suit. I still got it. So I had an instinct that things could go wrong. So I'm not going to say I was prepared for things to go wrong, but I was accepting the fact that it could go wrong.
What made you think that you could endure what was to come?
Well, again, when I said, you know, I was prepared in a kind of extraordinary way for what was to come, because I had been blind as a girl, as a little girl. I was blind for 3.5 years. So I had had that experience. I had also polio, and I was paralyzed for more than 1 year. I had suffered quite a lot. And so I had a very wonderful grandfather who did not accept weaklings very easily. So one had to learn to put up with pain. And even when I was blind, he was absolutely marvelous and would not accept the fact that I could not be a little more clever than I thought I could be. So, you know, I was prepared in a way. And this feeling in my family that we all had, boy or girl, to do our duty, not only to our country but to our father, was with me. All those things put together, I was so prepared.
When you said to Vera Atkins that you would wear this suit in captivity, did you really think that you would be caught?
Yes. In some ways, I hoped I wouldn't be, of course, because that's not the right way to think. And then when it was decided what I would do in France, I thought, well, there is more chance, because I felt all the time that if I could be more on my own, I would last for as long as necessary. I would not be captured. But things changed because I had to pass by Cannes, where Peter Churchill, known as Raoul, was already working, in order to get some papers to cross the demarcation line to go to Auxerre, where I was supposed to start a réseau. And when I was there in Cannes, the Italians came to occupy the south of France. So orders came to London that I should stay there and work with Raoul. Well, that I did not want to do, because I never wanted to work in the south of France, and I wanted to really be on my own. But circumstances were such that that never happened. I never went to where I should have gone. And the other thing was that I knew very well that by working in Cannes, I was going to work with a large réseau, a large group of people who were not specially security-minded. And therefore, it was it was very much a possibility that anything could happen anytime, anywhere.
Was there anything about the training which you didn't like? Any aspect of the training?
No, I think it was very good training for what people were supposed to be doing.
Is there any part of the training which you enjoyed?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think I was fascinated by it. I think more not so much by the physical part of the training, because I don't think I was any good at it, not really, but the pattern of it. I was very intrigued by the pattern of it. I thought that was very, very clever, really. The preparation, if you like, of one's mind, that was quite good.
You, in the biography which was written of you by Tickell, he says that you had problems with getting some, I think the man was called Jan, to take you in the felucca.
Yes, the Pole.
How did you persuade
him? Well, he was a very brave man, who had done quite a number of crossings, very dangerous crossings, of course. You can imagine, from Gibraltar to France in a fishing boat, in all kind of seas. Well, I had been refused by the Navy when they were asked to send me to France by submarine. They said no, they were not going to have a woman on one of their submarines. They never had and never would. So the submarine was out of the way. I had tried to go by air, and every time I stepped into an aircraft, something happened to it. So I think I was getting to be too costly. So they said, well, all right, from Gibraltar to France in that fishing boat. And then, when I got to Gibraltar, This man refused to take me. He said, what am I going to do with women on board? Well, I said, we do anything. I'm washing up or something. Anyway, he had orders that, you know, if he liked it or not, he was supposed to take us to France. And so he did. So he didn't make things terribly easy, but we didn't manage to get there.
When you got to Cannes, were you surprised at the activities and size of the réseau?
Yes, because I wasn't supposed to know about it, really, because I wasn't supposed to stay there or work there. So I had to discover that once I was supposed to be working with them. Yes, I was. I thought that Peter Churchill, or Raoul, as he was, certainly had done a lot of groundwork there and established a really large réseau with the French. I was worried about it, worried by its size, some of its people. But, you know, it had nothing to do with me. I wasn't the commanding officer there. I was under orders.
You were worried because you thought it was insecure?
Yes, I did.
Did you ever suspect that it might have been infiltrated?
At that time, I wasn't in a position to be that suspicious about it. Even I had doubts about one or two people. Perhaps it's unfair to say that I simply did not trust them. I did not like them and did not trust them. So I thought, my own personal feelings do not come into this. It has nothing to do with what I feel or think. If they do their job very well, all to the good, it isn't for me to. Strangely enough, it was proved to be right.
Which individuals didn't you trust?
Well, I don't think I want to start naming people after all those years, and I think it is very well known those who were not to be trusted. I mean, it's been written about, everybody who knows about those times and years, it has appeared in so many books and everything. So I think really it was an instinct in me at the time that just proved to be right in the passage of time.
Can I ask you some questions about your captivity?
Yes.
When the Gestapo were asking you the questions
at first,
did you know the answers to the questions?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Yes. Yes, I could have told them what they wanted to know just like that. They wanted to know where our radio operator was. They wanted to know where another British agent would arrive some little time before had been to and was probably gone to. Yes, they wanted to know things about people they didn't manage to capture. And in fact, they never did capture this British agent. And they did not even capture the radio operator. He came back to England and was captured when he went back to France. But he wasn't captured because of us.
Did you ever at any stage feel like weakening and answering the questions?
Well, you see, it's very, very difficult to answer such a thing without sounding sort of so terribly sure that one is brave and courageous and all that. And it's no good. I mean, I am not brave. I am not courageous. I just make up my own mind about certain things. And when they started sort of the treatment of me, I'm not going to say that I thought, you know, this is fun. I thought, well, there must be a breaking point. Even if in your own mind you don't want to break up, but physically you're bound to break up after a certain time, I suppose. If I can survive the next minute without breaking up, this is another minute of life. And if I can think that way, instead of thinking of what's going to happen in half an hour's time, having torn my toenails, they were going to do my fingers. When they were stopped because the commandant came in and he said, stop. And then they had burned my back. But of course, there are many other things they can do to me. Now, I've lived through those things. I have the experience of that's past. Now, what next is coming? How do I know? I can only hope for the best, but I know I've been able to accept this and to survive it. And now there must be a moment when you cannot, no matter how much you want to, nature is stronger than you are or something, and you can't. But if I accept that it will not be my decision, if they kill me, they will kill me physically, but that's all. They won't win anything. What is the point? They'll have a dead body, useless to them. But they will not have me, because I won't let them have me. So from the moment you accept that, some extraordinary, I don't know what it is, grace, I don't know. It's no good saying that you do it by yourself. It's a kind of bargaining. Some people would say with God, some people would say, I don't know. I don't know what comes, but it comes.
Did you feel it was a matter of personal honor not to say anything?
I felt it was a duty. I had been brought up all my life with a sense of duty. I had been trained with a sense of duty. I was a woman with a sense of duty to life. That was part of it.
Were you a religious believer then? Were you a Christian?
I was brought up very much in the church, if you like. But again, I got married, I was busy with my children and all that. I was really, I was a religious person, but not a religious person to think that I could be a martyr or anything of the kind. No.
But you believed in God?
I believe in God. And you see, my belief in God is I believe in the soul of people. I believe that we all have a soul, that we don't know where it comes from, what it's made of. It's our own. We don't know what happens to it. And I believe we've got to use it for the best possible things that you can do with it. I have great respect for the human beings, because I think they are miracles. I think human beings are miracles. I mean, you can invent the atom bomb, you can create fantastic robots, you can do everything like that today. But who is ever going to create such a miracle as the mind of a human being?
What did you think about the people who were perpetrating the torture?
You see, that was clever, because the Germans nearly always found somebody of your own nationality to torture you, so that you could never say I was tortured by a German. And in my case, it was a very good-looking young Frenchman. And I felt he was a sick man. And I think all those people who were doing those things were mentally sick. In fact, I told him, because on Remembrance Day, I had been in prison since April, and then in November on Remembrance Day, 10 o'clock one evening, I was taken out of my cell and taken down the courtyard of the prison. There was a car waiting with two men in uniform, and my man who had tortured me, who was not in uniform, and said, as you are such devoted to your country and everything else, I thought you'd like to go to the Arc de Triomphe on the 11th of November and see the German guards standing there. So we went, believe it or not, round and round the Arc de Triomphe. And I said to him, they are there now, but how long for? And I said to him, you like doing what you are doing, the job you are doing? I said to him, you are a sick man, you like doing this. And actually, I was right, because I discovered after the war that he was the son of very well-to-do people from Elbeuf, near Rouen, a very good family indeed, who were absolutely broken-hearted to discover they had a son like that, who was condemned to death, of course, after the war. But let's face it, if it would not have been for the circumstances of the war, he probably would have married a nice girl and have children, and nobody would have ever known what he was made of.
It sounds as though you didn't hate him.
No, because I soon discover, you know, to begin with, when you are like that, obviously you want revenge. You want to be able to do to those who do things like that to people the same kind of thing so they should learn what it's like. And then you discover that if you think that way, you are going to end up being as they are. It doesn't do anybody any good at all. You've got to dismiss all that and say, well, I am healthy. They are sick. I don't have to be sick. I don't have to be bitter, because bitterness creates such terrible misery that you live with it inside yourself. It's there all the time, like some kind of cancer. So what is the point of being like that? You have to keep